And welcome to the Tree Lightering. We're here for another week of book-related ambling and rambling. Ooh, I rhymed, I didn't even turn to, and just like it came out like that, I'm well proud. So, I'm Andrew, and here today I am joined by Rob and Jordan here on the Geek Show Podcast Network, because I always didn't mention that bit.
Yes. I'm currently almost giving Andrew a very withering look, because
he
ruined his poetry moment.
I did.
By saying, well proud.
Well, I felt like I had to kind of balance
It'd have been better, right, if you didn't actually
draw attention to the fact that he rhymed. He just secretly gloated that he's superior to everyone else because he can rhyme in secret.
It's just probably so secret I surprised myself.
Yes, this is true.
Until you mentioned it.
Anyway, we got all sorts today. We have news. We have a book we're talking about, which is... It is all kinds of awesome.
We're talking about a book on the book show.
Yes.
Oh, dark days indeed.
Yes, we're even talking about funny books on the book show later on. So,
funny
before
books.
That...
Wasn't that a TV show?
I don't know. I don't do TV. Well, except... Well,
until this afternoon.
Yeah, until this afternoon we do the TV
it's
show.
It's already afternoon.
Until later this afternoon, then, you pedantic so-and-so. Anyway, we have news, so who wants to kick us off?
I think I will.
Okay.
Tintin.
From the spit, Tintin.
Are we on about that
Tintin
one?
Tintin that ran Tempestin.
Yeah. Are we on about that one where they had the cartoon that started off as Hershey's Adventures of Tintin?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Okay. Now I know who you're on about.
Imagine being an expert at Tintin.
I don't need to imagine.
An expert at Tintin.
How can you be an expert at Tintin?
Tintin expert appointed UK's first comics professor.
How can you be an expert at Tintin?
Not a clue.
I've read all the Tintin. Does that make me an expert?
Have you watched all the TV show episodes?
Yes.
And the movies?
Yes.
And more importantly, all of Teesside Tintin.
And Teesside Tintin, yes.
Teesside Tintin isn't canon.
Aw.
It's the only canon that matters, Rob.
I'll have you know, it's not canon. It's actually papier-mâché in the shape of a cannon.
It's brilliant. Lancaster University shows full academic commitment to comics and graphics, graphic book art with the appointment of Ben R. Peters.
Can I just say one thing?
No.
They've appointed him as professor of comics, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, okay, cool. He's a Tintin expert, but I would be more impressed if he was a Superman expert, or an expert on Golden Age comics, or a Batman expert, or bloody hell, an X-Men expert, for crying out loud.
An expert,
yes. For crying out loud, how many different X-Men could he reference? He'd need to be a professor just to go into detail about all of the different X-Men and all of the different timelines and all of the different X-Men comics. Superman is even worse, and Batman is just kind of a nightmare.
Well, just all of DC Comics, because what is continuity with them?
Yes. Either that, or I would call him an expert if he was an expert on 90s comics. Because what the hell was going on with Marvel then?
Yes, Rob, because they didn't see you putting your thumb up for him.
Yes, you can.
I can, but nobody else can.
It's a good thumb. It's a left thumb.
It's a good thumb.
I was just showing you my thumb to prove that I had one.
Okay.
It wasn't like, you know, a thumbs up. It was just like, it's a thumb. My left one.
Fair enough.
There you go. It's a good thumb. Our powers unite.
Andrew over there is feeling left out.
I just had to watch on in horror as John and Rob linked thumbs.
No, we touched thumbs.
Touched thumbs.
I said, our powers unite.
And now Jordan is 50% more Rob, and Rob is 50% more Jordan, and everything is awful. Help me.
No.
Anyway.
Yeah. Tintin expert Ben R. Peters.
Benoit Peters.
Has been appointed the UK's first ever comics professor in a move which Lancaster University has marked its full academic commitment to comic book art.
So is he a professor of comic books or a professor of comic book art?
I don't know. It's not saying.
Because they're not exactly the same thing.
Peters, author of a biography of Tintin's creator Hergé and other titles about the quiffed Belgian adventurer. There's a nice little pronunciation for you into that one.
The quiffed Belgian adventurer.
Yeah. Will take up his 3-year post as a visiting professor in graphic fiction and comic art next summer.
Okay, right. That clarifies
okay,
it.
Yes, it's like kind of the writing and the pictures.
Yeah.
He will, said Lancaster, be delivering a series of lectures, running creative writing workshops, and supervising postgraduate students. The university has described his appointment as to what is said to be the first such position in the UK as significant.
Can I just ask, where did he get his qualifications and in what? I'm curious, because if his qualifications aren't in comics, then I'm challenging this decision. Unless he went to the University of Stan Lee.
Nice.
I was wondering where you were going to go with that.
Mm. Yeah.
It was a terrible joke. And yet somehow I'm still surprised.
I know. Hang on, why are you surprised?
I don't
know. It's me and it's terrible jokes. We kind of go hand in hand. You've seen us skipping down the street, you know, terrible joke on my right, terrible joke on my left, and me in the middle, you know, swinging me like I'm some five-year-old
terrible
kid.
Joke right behind you, then slipping on a banana peel and falling over.
And that it demonstrates full academic commitment to place in comic book art, not just in its creative writing and literature department, but also across the wider disciplines, including philosophy.
Question.
I don't know if I can answer this one for you.
I repeal the question then.
Is it a real question or another
question? It was a real question. Right. They're talking about comics and graphic literature and stuff like that.
He did write his PhD on the comics medium.
On the comics medium?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. See, my main question is this. Comics, by their nature, are generally viewed as the realm of superheroes, stuff like that. Now, we here in this room, we know that comics are more than that. And we've read loads of comics that are far more than just the typical superhero fix problems by punching them.
Iron Man?
Just about every superhero.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's a problem. Oh, no, this person is having marital problems. I'll punch them until they go away. Oh no, this child is lost. I'll punch things until the child is found. Oh no, there's a massive traffic jam.
Punch all the traffic out the way.
Yes.
Off a talkie just runs through it all.
Yeah, no, don't. Because I'm just...
elbows each and every car out the way.
No, I'm releasing an episode of 4-Panel that we recorded. I had to call it the Ten Commandments of Hulk. Do you remember this, Andy?
Oh, yes. Hulk versus Attack on Titan.
Yes. It kind of went from that. And we went on this story about how, you know, everyone's suddenly thanking Hulk for saving the human race from the Titans. And they're building statues to Hulk that just say Hulk is strongest there is. And Hulk is finally at peace because the world gets him. They finally get him. They finally like Hulk for being Hulk.
That was a weird show.
It's fun, though.
I mean, not by our standards, but I mean, by like any other standards, it was a weird show.
Yeah, but I mean, the Ten Commandments of Hulk.
Yes, Ten Commandments.
We do need to make those a reality. What was it? The first commandment was Hulk smash good.
I'm sure this will be a t-shirt somewhere.
Hulk not smash, puny.
Puny.
Yes. Commandment number 3, Hulk is strongest there is. Commandment number 4, repeat commandment number 1.
Lovely. By the time we got to 4, we'd kind of run out of ideas.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, so Hulk. Hulk you could do all sorts with, because it is basically the Jekyll and Hyde. If you're looking at it in terms of characters themselves, then I suppose there are stuff that you can talk about. But I'd like to know where manga is going to fit into all of this, because manga is a comic book form. And when it comes to the crossover between literature and pop culture, manga is probably the one place where it happens the most. Because there are manga out there that really are works of literature, not works of pop culture.
Benoit Peters is a comics writer, novelist, and critic.
And? I'm a critic.
So, yeah, but you're not a comics writer.
Yeah, so...
Maybe the way there's... I mean, he's done a degree in philosophy. Right, so it's one of them things. Maybe they're actually using the philosophy side and the comics, the fact that he is a comics writer.
I've got qualifications
to actually do it like that, if you know what I mean.
Hmm.
So
I'm just saying, aside from, he might be a comics writer, but I'm also a writer. I also have qualifications in philosophy, and I'm a critic.
Yeah, but how many essays on Tintin have you written?
None, because Tintin is boring as balls. No, I tell a lie. Tintin was interesting, but there's a limitation to how interesting Tintin can be. You know, you've got to add the T-side to make it more interesting.
Well, I'll just go back to the good old days when Tintin was a thundering racist.
Oh, God, yes. Yes.
Okay, I actually have a copy of Tintin in the Congo at home. Oh, just because it's so racist.
Oh, I remember that. I remember reading that when I was a kid. And I was just kind of, looks like my cousin, looks like a guy I know, looks like my cousin, looks like a guy I know. I'm like, yeah, this is not good. Anyway, let's leave the original thundering racist who's now reformed called Tintin, or the adventurer, or the Belgian adventurer with a quiff.
No, the quiffed Belgian adventurer.
The quiffed Belgian adventurer. So, hang on.
I think that sounds such better, right, than the Adventures of Tintin.
Well,
the Adventures of the Belgian, the quiffed Belgian adventurer.
Tintin. Was Captain Haddock Belgian then?
I don't know. That's.
Oh, was he Scottish? Because he lived in Marlin Spike Hall, didn't he?
Hmm.
I don't know. I'm confused now. It's like whether he was always Scottish, or like whether he was meant to be Belgian and then.
Because they did try and pass him off as being Scottish quite a lot, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they made him alcoholic, so.
Well, no, he wore a kilt in one of those little Scottish berets.
Yeah.
In some of the comics.
Yeah, he's got to have been Scottish then.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Then the question I've got is, right, Tintin would pop over and see Captain Haddock quite a lot.
Yeah, but I mean, he could have been living in Belgium.
In Marlin Spike Hall in Belgium.
Yes, because geography isn't a thing.
Oh, God, yeah, because the Congo is around the corner.
Yeah.
Yes, the Congo, where they all apparently drink umbongo and... I don't know. Lions pick passion fruits and various things like that. Who knows? It's a crazy place. Let's move on before I get into serious trouble.
Yes, we are on a line and we need to back away from it.
Yes. So what's next? Who's next? I believe you're next.
Yes, I'm next and I will just unlock my phone. Done. Okay, so it is James Dawson has criticized parents who attacked his LGBT guide for children.
Okay, an LGBT guide for children.
Yes, basically it's called This Book is Gay, and it's kind of a young adult novel aimed at kind of helping LGBT teens. That was a lot harder to say than I thought it was going to be. Come to terms with kind of how they are.
Okay, when you say young adult, who's it aimed at? What sort of age group?
I would assume kind of the usual sort of...
So 15, 16.
Yeah, mainly 15 to 16-year-olds, I would think.
Okay, so 15 to 16-year-olds, okay, fine. Kind of understand. And at that point, they're really starting to explore things. And with the wonders of the internet...
Exactly. And
there's
like, a lot usually,
of things they can explore.
This would be the point where like we would say, oh, shame on these silly, bigoted, homophobic people for trying to ban it.
But
I think for once, they actually kind of have a point.
Yep.
Because basically the book was in the juvenile fiction section of a library and also contains quite graphic descriptions and even pictures of sex acts.
Okay, that puts a different spin on things.
Yeah, like one of the parents is complaining that their 10-year-old picked it up.
Wow.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it needs to be banned, but it certainly needs some kind of like age warning. Yeah.
It needs some kind of age warning, definitely. Or it needs... No, it doesn't need plain brown covers, but it needs some...
Oh, I found a line from the book.
Oh, God, go then.
As with hand jobs and breakfast eggs, all men like their blowjobs differently.
As with hand jobs and breakfast eggs?
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, God, no, I've got that song, How Do You Like Your Eggs in the Morning? I don't remember the first three. I like mine with a hand job.
With some soldiers.
That's the uncensored version.
No, with some soldiers. This is the uncensored version.
A lot of dunking going on. I couldn't even finish that one.
Oh, with a creamy yolk. Oh, I just ruined eggs for myself. I can never eat eggs again. I don't.
No, I can still eat eggs.
Yes. I'm really stuck on this one. I don't think it's a good idea to include blatant pornography in a book that's designed for you know, even if it's for young adults, it's still children reading it.
Yeah, you need to be more careful. I think kind of the problem is that there's pretty extreme views on both sides.
Well, here's the thing, right? And actually, here's a good point. I made this argument when it came to anime, right? Because in anime, there is a thing. It seems like because people have this perception that cartoons are for kids, they can get away with more stuff, like casual nudity and various things like that. Mm-hmm. There is a series which was released in, I think it was May last year, called High School DxD or High School DD, right? And it was released in the UK uncensored, which meant full frontal nudity and various things like that. Lower bits barely covered. And you had characters of all sizes and a range of ages. This was all in a show that was certified by the BBFC at an age of 15. Okay, now I...
Yeah, you done messed up there, BBFC.
I severely disagreed with this. I thought it should have been an 18 because of the amount and the sexualized nature of that amount of nudity in the series.
Well, yeah, that's like the definition of what would make a thing an 18.
And my question to people who were arguing with me was, okay, a couple of things that you might want to ask yourself then. Number one, would you watch this in front of your parents? Most of them said no. If you had kids or girlfriends, would you watch this in front of them? Right? Would you watch this in front of your kids? Most of them said no. I said, now, here's another question then. If this was live action, what age rating would you give it? And all of them said 18, straight away. Hmm. And that's all I'm going to say with this one. If it was actually people in front of you on a screen, actual real actors doing those acts on a screen.
Okay, because I can say what you said. If it was actual real people in front of you.
Then that's just voyeurism.
Yeah.
But if it was,
you've stepped into the wrong kind of club.
Yes. If it was actors on a screen playing out that particular scene, it would be an 18 rated at least.
Yeah, it'd be super 18.
Yeah. So there's my point. It shouldn't even be in a 15, 16 year old thing. Because at the end of the day, imagination is a great thing. Trying to explain things is a great thing, but you don't need to explain it like that. They know the mechanics, so you can infer. You don't need to go, oh, look, I'm going to be shocking and hammer the point home by...
And I think that works better because if you're a child reading that and you can't infer what they mean, then clearly you're too young to be reading a book about man sex.
Or woman sex.
Or woman sex. But in this case, it is man sex.
But you understand that.
Yeah, but what you could do there is just give them Brokeback Mountain, tell them we're going to watch it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Even with Brokeback Mountain, a lot of it was inferred.
Yeah.
You know? It's not like you go onto the DVD of Brokeback Mountain and, oh no, there's Jake Gyllenhaal's Todger.
Nope, I definitely do not remember Jake Gyllenhaal's man sausage.
Nope, I don't remember it. And I don't remember Heath Ledger doing anything with his man sausage either. I remember a lot of staring intently at each other. It inferred a lot, but you never actually need to see it, did you? And that's my point. As you said, if you're too young to understand what's being inferred, then you're too young to read the book. It's that simple.
Yeah, see, it's an easy fix.
Yeah, not only that, by inferring it, you're actually showing more sensitivity towards the subject matter than normal because you're not being blatant about it and saying, oh, this is this and this is this. Oh, look at me. I know what I'm talking about. Just inferring it shows that you are sensitive enough to understand that maybe people don't want to talk about it in public.
And especially not with pictures.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think I'm going to have to side with the parents on this one. I wouldn't normally. Normally we would probably take the line of, you know, equality and stuff like that and basically standing up for the rights of the LGBT crowd. But I think this book isn't doing the LGBT crowd any favours at all.
No, and especially like when you read things by the author who said that like he thought writing a controversial book would make him a bit of a rock star. It's like he's clearly gone into this knowing there's going to be some backlash.
Yeah, but the backlash, I don't think the backlash has even started yet because I think if once the LGBT crowd gets in on this, then the backlash will really start. And I, to be honest, we all know people who are homosexual, bisexual, transgender, whatever. Of all the people that we know, would any of them be happy with this book?
No, they definitely wouldn't be.
Exactly. Because it's not helping them in any way. So yeah, I don't think the LGBT crowd are going to be happy with this either. This is just the start of the backlash for this guy, I reckon.
Yeah, so I think we're going to have to keep an eye on this story then.
Yep. Mm. Speaking of eyes, let's move on to some really creepy Art Attack eyes.
Was some segue.
That was.
Well, you remember the eyes on this statue of H.P. Lovecraft.
Yep, they are burned into my soul.
They're huge and buggy and Art Attack-y. And the organizers of the World Fantasy Awards are calling for artists to submit new designs for their trophy to replace the previous statuette. This is mainly because an online petition condemned Lovecraft as an avowed racist.
Shall I bring you back to our first story as well?
Yes. Yes, it is. Full circle, see? Now, since they've opened this up to artists, I thought, why don't we think of a design for the World Fantasy Award of our own?
Because we are, of course, all very artistic.
No.
No, it's not the artistic thing you want. It's
but
the
have
creative,
you seen the old
the
creativity
one?
The old one looks like it was made by a blind 5-year-old.
This is a good point. Well, it's...
Who had nightmares every single day.
So it's a fantasy award, right?
Yes. Unless it's a statue of Terry Pratchett. Right? He's the only person I would say, if it's fantasy, then give him a statue of Pratchett, you know? Mm. Or give him a... No. Give him a hat, like Pratchett used to wear.
Yes! The Pratchett
give them
hat.
A hat. Give them the Pratchett hat. But make it look like a flying saucer.
Yeah, that's like sci-fi and fantasy combined.
Yes. There you go. There's a winner.
Oh, God damn it. That's better than my idea.
I win.
But you know what my idea is, don't you?
Which one?
Well, it's Fantasy World, right?
Yeah.
Wizard staff.
Oh, God, no. Did you decorate it and put scroll work on?
I did.
Wow. Wow.
And you thought they were wrinkles.
Haven't even seen the gemstone yet.
Yeah. That's a huge cat's eye. Jordan, what about you? Any ideas for the World Fantasy Art?
Not that the tone is suitably low enough.
You can only raise it from here, Charlie.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I was thinking like that is basically fantasy, Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. It's going to have to have the dragon on the top. Something like that, right? You can have anything else underneath like that. Just...
I mean, if we're gonna be...
Just have a dragon over a world.
I know. You could combine the two. So the winner gets a dragon, and then the loser is placed in a dungeon.
I like this. I like this a lot. This is good. We like this.
Yeah, but don't forget, right, winning that dragon like that is going to be like...
Is it a real dragon?
I would say, right, because there's laws against actually having a dragon, so...
Yeah, I know. It's just a dragon is basically a flying tank come battleship because it depends on how big the dragon is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's basically at least a flying tank. And
there's some laws against that.
Yeah, you're not allowed to drive your tank without a special license.
Yeah.
So does that mean you have to have a special license to fly your dragon?
Special permit.
Yeah, special permit. Is there like a department in the government for this?
It's like when you
do
get...
you have to do like a test? You know, do you have to have like an instructor next to you? Are there like air signs that you have to? Do you have to? You know, if you signal left on your dragon, do you have to stick your arm out and wave it up and down like that?
You've also got to get it microchipped.
Oh, and you have to. It's got to be inoculated against all sorts of things.
Yes.
Fleas. Do dragons get fleas? My God, how do you check?
I don't know. It's a massive
creature.
It'd be like crocodile, wouldn't it? Like that, right? So it might get scale rot.
Yeah, it might do. But then dragon scales are supposed to be like hard as tungsten. So how do you know?
See, I think the real problem is going to be when there's a massive scandal over the emissions test.
Oh, God, no, because both ends. This is a weapon. This is for propulsion. Did we just destroy your idea of dragons?
But don't
forget
that.
Attach like a little bind thing to the end of the tail.
Yes.
don't forget, right, if it's winged, like, all right, you can also say it's wind power, which means the emission stuff like that goes down a notch.
Yeah, this is true. The big problem with dragons, though, is that, yeah, they might make great watchdogs, but you're not going to get your stuff back off them.
That's true.
And at some point, it's just going to be there watching your box set of, like, I don't, Fringe or something like that. Going, go on, protect it yourself then.
Fringe and not Game of Thrones, Rob.
Yeah.
You can imagine,
you missed
like,
the easy joke.
No. I didn't say Game of Thrones on purpose, because if it sees Game of Thrones, it might start bowing to every blonde woman it sees.
Yeah, but training that dragon to go...
No, yes, Deborah Megan. Oh. Bowing to her. Getting fly up to her collar, Khaleesi.
Training that dragon, right, to go and fetch your mail.
Yeah, I'm sure Deborah
Megan... Get a sit down right and wait in the corner and everything like that.
Yeah, we're talking about Deborah Megan from Dragon's Den. I'm sure she can train a dragon to do that.
I thought she was a dragon.
Yeah, no, surely...
She's the British, the rich British version of Khaleesi.
Ah, okay.
Maybe we should just save money and get, like, Theo Pavitis or someone to be the award. It's like, he's not doing anything now, is he?
Oh, does that mean... Oh, God. If Deborah Megan is Khaleesi, does that mean... what? You know, who's that really tall one?
Peter Jones.
Is he Khal Drogo in disguise? Is he just like the taller British version of Jason Momoa? This works.
They could be twins.
Which means he could be playing Manta in the Aquaman movie.
Yes.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Well, they always make the bad guy somebody British anyway, so why not? And hell, if Paris Hilton can have a movie career.
Yes, she can.
Yes. Anyway, yes. So
moving on.
Wait. Oh. I'm still imagining Paris Hilton getting javelin through the face.
House of Wax. Yeah. Have you had your moment?
I've had my moment. We can move on now.
Okay, right. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be back after this message with a book. We have a book.
Hello. Do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
Hello and welcome back to Literary Lightroom. Now we're going to have a book review, strange enough, on a book show.
Yes, this is The Emperor of All Things by Paul Whitcover, and it's a book, and it's a very...
Good analysis.
It's a very, very, very interesting book, even as an epilogue. I never expected books to have epilogues these days.
Well, that's not so common now, is it?
Yeah, it's not. This is from Bantam Books and Transworld Books, basically Penguin Random House. And this is The Emperor of All Things by Paul Whitcover. It's set in, I think it was 1748 during the England-France War. And there's an interest... Sorry, 1758, it's... there's an interesting thing about this book, right? It is steampunk with powdered wigs.
Ooh, hold on, guys. Do you hear that? That is the sound of a certain section of nerddom getting incredibly hard.
Right, I will read a little bit from this book in a bit, but...
Careful, then the nerds will explode.
Yes. Anyway, it starts off with an oath, right? The first page of this book is an oath, and the oath is... I'm tempted to read it all, but I'm not going to. You shall swear to be true to our sovereign lord the king's majesty, his heirs and successors, and at all times obedient to the master of and wardens of this fellowship and society and their successors after them in all honest law and lawful things touching the affairs of this fellowship. You shall be ready at all manner of summons and bear scot and lot in all manner of reasonable contributions of this and to this fellowship, and the fellowship of the company of clockmakers of the city of London, you shall to the best of your skill, power, and ability uphold and maintain. It goes on. But this is basically the oath of allegiance to the fellowship of the company of clockmakers of the city of London. Who are actually a secretive organization who deal with time and timepieces and are working for the British royalty and the British government in the war against France, and this starts off in an attic with a mouse who got chased by a cat. But then the cat runs away because somebody dressed in grey drops through the roof in kind of a Garrett from Thief type thing, dressed all in grey with grey pouches and a grey scabbard with a short sword that's thin like a rapier, but not because it's short.
And they pick up grey.
Yep, and they pick up a clock, which looks like a normal carriage clock, from the workshop, which is covered in bits of clocks and other clocks, only to find out somebody has a pistol trained on them, right? And the person who has the pistol trained on them, I think his name's Lord Withcutt, right? Now, Lord Withcutt is the powdered wig I mentioned before. He's the first powdered wig you see. He is a noble of sorts, and he is after a specific timepiece, and he identifies the thief as Grimalkin, a legendary thief who used to work for the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers. And Grimalkin used to work for them, but he keeps telling Withcutt, "I have no master." He's basically freelance now. He's gone all over the world stealing all sorts of things. And Withcutt thinks that he's basically got the jump on Grimalkin. But Grimalkin points out that this clock is the one that Withcutt wants to keep hold of undamaged. And if he shoots Grimalkin, Grimalkin will drop the clock. Clock will get damaged, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, Grimalkin realizes that Withcutt has basically called him here because of some other reason, not to kill him. So Grimalkin basically says, "Okay, what do you want?" They have a discussion. Withcutt wants Grimalkin to work for him. Grimalkin says no. Three people come out. They're all professional killers. Withcutt fires a shot, then tells Grimalkin, "It was a fake anyway. Ha ha." At which point, Withcutt's trying to reload. But in the meantime, Grimalkin quickly kills the three professional killers and holds his blade against Withcutt's throat, gets his parole that Withcutt won't scream or cry out or anything like that while he escapes. Withcutt agrees because he's a noble and a gentleman with a powdered wig and a beauty mark, right? And so Grimalkin, believing in the word of a British gentleman, decides to leave. And as he's going, he sees a clock that looks kind of plain compared to the other clocks. And he's like, "You thought you could hide it from me? Well, you're a fool." Takes the actual clock he was after. Starts to leave while Withcutt is shouting for guards because Grimalkin has the right
because
clock.
Duh.
But here's the thing. Grimalkin drops a smoke bomb and ends up on a rooftop half a mile away with his pet mouse, Henrietta, and he's just about to look at his spoils when he gets coshed over the head and knocked out. Enter the main character.
Oh.
Wow.
Okay, I was going to say, because this sounds like really cliche after this point.
Nope. Enter the main character, Daniel Quare. Now, Daniel Quare is a journeyman of the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers. And he basically works for two masters. He works for the guy who's in charge of the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers, who's Grandmaster Thaddeus Wolfe. And he also works for his mentor, Theophilus Magnus. Now, Thaddeus Wolfe, the Grandmaster, he's very traditional. He basically wants the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers to basically keep doing what they've been doing for all this time. Whereas Magnus is very much an innovator. He's always looking for new ways of doing things, more efficient, more achievements, that sort of thing. And somehow or other, without actually trying to, Quare, who basically recovers this clock from Grimalkin, ends up on the bad side of Magnus and also one of Magnus's disciples, but makes Wolf happy. Problem is, Quare is an agent, right? He's kind of the 1758 version of James Bond. And this is where it gets really odd.
Because this is odd already.
No, as if it wasn't odd already. But this is effectively a spy, steampunk, various things like that, all rolled up into one and set in 1758. And I like Quare as a character because he likes hanging out in dives. He likes hanging out in places where there's lots of beer and buxom wenches. Now, he's normally tight-lipped about what's going on until he's had a beer, at which point he turns into Bruce Wayne. He just lets the nearest woman, the nearest guy who's buying him drinks, he tells them immediately he's Batman.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, have you noticed Bruce Wayne? How many people know he's Batman? Mm. Seriously. It's like everybody. I'm amazed that Commissioner Gordon still hasn't figured it out. Buy him some drinks, Gordon.
That was the worst bit of The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, I know.
He just goes, oh, now I've worked it out. Even though, like, literally there was the one guy who was like, yeah, I just worked it out just because I could.
Yeah, exactly. This is very Dickensian in its approach, and weirdly enough, it works. See, Quare has a problem. He's picked up a Hunter pocket watch. Now, it's very thin silver, but it's got bits that are made out of bone, and it's powered by blood, and it could also fall into the category of a weapon of mass destruction. Now, England could use it in the war against France, but France also could use it in the war against England. Everybody wants it, and Quare doesn't think anybody should have it. So Quare is kind of trying to keep everybody from realizing that he has it, while at the same time trying to do his job for the worshipful company of clockmakers, who kind of suspect that he has it, but can't prove that he has it, but also know that he has it, and don't do anything about it because they think, well, what the hell, he's there, we can get it any time kind of thing. It all gets very, very convoluted and complicated with who knows what and what knows where and who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third. I managed to sneak in an Abbott and Costello reference as well.
Well done.
I'm really proud of this. Let's see how many more I can go for. Anyway, here's the thing. This book is essentially in three parts, right? The first part is all about how Quare gets this watch and the fact that he ends up having to go gallivanting from various place to place, like James Bond, but in 1758, with lots of powdered wigs and, you know, and tight hose and cravats and various things like that and fake beauty marks and stuff. And he's in this world, and this world is basically, it is 18th century London through and through. Then the scene shifts, right? Now, the scene shifts to something a bit like Paradise Lost, to a village that is kind of outside of time and not at the same time. And it shifts to Witchcote. And Lord Witchcote has ended up in this village, in this kind of Lost Horizon scenario, and there's a clock tower in this village, but it doesn't quite work the way he thinks it works. Because he thinks initially it's just an ordinary clock tower, but it's not. The residents there also have a secret. Now, Witchcote somehow ends up with the nickname Longinus.
As you do.
Right? And he falls in love and then has to leave because he's a human. And that place is kind of a place where humans shouldn't be. And that's what gets him on this path to wanting to find and control the nature of time. Just to give you an example, this is close to the beginning of the book, right? So it's not actually spoiling anything. This is what Witchcote says, trying to get Grimalkin on his side. The man bristled. Do you take me for a shopkeeper, sir? A common artisan? I am a peer of the realm. Such petty restrictions do not apply to the likes of me. Nor do I claim exemption on the grounds of rank alone. I am a natural scientist, an investigator into the secret nature of the most elusive and mysterious of all substances in God's creation. I refer, of course, to time. That is our true master, is it not, Grimalkin? That is our true master, is it not, Grimalkin? Tempus rerum imperator. As the worshipful company has it, time, the emperor of all things.
And there's the title drop, okay, roll credits.
Yes. And, yeah, he likes Grimalkin, be damned. Because he does say it like that. I like you, sir, be damned. I love the dialogue in this. I love the dialogue. It's so 18th century, it hurts. And there's something just so amazingly good about it. And there were loads of occasions when I was reading this, and it felt it was basically Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but as a steampunk spy novel type thing.
Ah, oh, the plenty of have at yous.
Yes, have at you, sir. And you know, I challenge you to a duel. There is one weird bit in this, and that's when they go into
just the one weird bit.
No, this one is slightly weirder than most, and I'm sure Michael Moorcock has something to say about this if he doesn't already. And this is brilliant. There are the Troglodytian dwellers, or Troglodytian dwellers, however you want to call them, who live below London. And their name is the Morcocknians.
Morcocknians?
Yes.
Because they're more Cockney than the rest.
Yes, they are more Cockney than the rest. But also, I'm sure Michael Moorcock has some part to play in this. And yeah, I was like, the Morcocknians? Really? Is this kind of a play on the whole Morlock thing?
Who knows?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
If it's Cockney Morlocks, I want to read this book.
They are effectively Cockney Morlocks. Anyway, after the Paradise Lost bit, it goes back to Quare, but this time he's up against dragons and magic and various things like that, because basically by this point the acid has really kicked in. And a lot of people are saying about this book that it gets confusing towards the end and they weren't quite sure what was going on. Well, I didn't know what was going on, but I loved every minute of it. I thought, I'm still trying to figure out bits of it. I sit there and I'm like, that's what that meant. You know, it's like those, you know, when they talk about those weird 60s acid flashbacks you get when you suddenly remember and have a moment of clarity. This book is a bit like that. In that you have these moments when you'll just be sitting there doing nothing, or maybe waiting for a bus, or watching, you know, something on the Idiot Box. I don't know. And then all of a sudden you remember a scene from that book and you go, that's what that meant. It's like that.
It's cool. I like books like that.
Yeah, books that kind of stay in your mind without you realizing it. And this is quite definitively one of those books. Some bits of it do not make a jot of sense at all. I still try to figure out how the Paradise Lost bit fits into the rest of the narrative, because the rest of the narrative is basically, you know, my name's Quare, Daniel Quare. I'll see you and raise you, Moriarty. There's nobody called Moriarty in this, by the way. I couldn't remember any Bond villains, so I went with the Sherlock Holmes one. But yeah, basically Daniel Quare is 18th century James Bond with a little bit of Jason Bourne thrown in, because there are sword fights left, right, and centre in this. It's glorious, you know, because they're very 18th century sword fights, so they're very formal. You know, nobody just walks in and hacks someone else's head off. Everybody's just kind of, you know, they have to have conversation while they fight.
Of course, because if you can't, like, have casual danger conversation while sword fighting, what's even the point?
Thing is, those bits all remind me of The Princess Bride.
Oh, now you've piqued my interest.
They remind me of The Princess Bride, not so much in the tone of the conversation, but the fact that in one scene, there's a fight between two characters, and what they're talking about has nothing to do with the fight.
It's basically just like the sword fight between Inigo and Wesley for like the entire book.
Yes, kind of.
I want to read it.
Well, not for the entire book, but basically, yeah, what they're talking about has nothing to do with the fight at all. And he's kind of, well, why are you fighting then? Could you not have just had a cup of tea, maybe a crumpet or some scones, and discussed this? I mean, it does kind of play fast and loose with the 18th century setting, and that's fine, you know. And it is England versus France, so go English. The thing that kind of bugs me a little bit is because this is effectively, Daniel Quare is effectively a spy, an 18th century spy. And he's not on the same level as, say, the Scarlet Pimpernel, because I love the Scarlet Pimpernel. Scarlet Pimpernel was the first hero with a secret identity.
Yeah, yeah.
The very first one, 1908, long before Zorro and anyone else. You know, well before Zorro, Batman, Superman,
yeah,
whoever. And Richard E. Grant, when he did the Scarlet Pimpernel on TV, that's when I became a fan of Richard E. Grant.
Richard E. Grant is fantastic.
Yeah, and he was brilliant as Scarlet Pimpernel. But yeah, Daniel Quare isn't on the level of the Scarlet Pimpernel, because Percy Blakeney was just, he was the fop's fop. He was the gentleman's gentleman. I mean that in every connotation. The guy was a tool to quite a lot of people, and he did it on purpose. Remember that Blue, the Grey, and the Bat?
Yes, was that the cowboy one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know what they modelled Bruce Wayne's character on for that? Tried to do that.
I assume it was Zorro, wasn't it?
No, no. They tried to model his foppish character on Percy Blakeney.
I only heard about it because it was Ben that read it.
Yeah. Don Diego's character from Zorro is also modelled on Percy Blakeney.
Oh, so Zorro is, like, based on the Scarlet Pimpernel?
Yes.
Which means technically Batman is based on the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yep.
It's all one long chain.
Yes, it is. But yeah, he lacks the kind of urbane, casual gentlemanness of Percy Blakeney, which is the main reason why he ends up in dives with buxom wenches and a very loose tongue about what the worshipful company of clockmakers are actually doing. And then he gets into trouble for letting everybody know what they're doing. And then he has to go and fix it. And then he causes more problems by getting drunk and wenching again. So he's in this vicious cycle, kind of like Bond. So yeah, The Emperor of All Things. Damn fine, damn enjoyable book. It is a damn enjoyable book. I'm looking forward to the sequel, which I'll hopefully be covering maybe not next week, or maybe next week or the week after. Depends on how quickly I finish it. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and I think is that the end of the show? I feel like it might be the end of the show.
Yeah, that is the end of the show.
That's the end of the show.
Oh, well.
We'll do the thing that we were going to
do. Yes, the thing that we didn't do.
The thing that we didn't do, which we're going to do, but just to whet your appetite, from Breaking Up by Bill Manville, I don't know how other men feel about their wives walking out on them, but I helped mine pack.
That's a good line.
More of that next week. But for now, thank you for listening to Literary Loitering. Emperor of All Things is available now from Penguin Random House, Bantam Books, Transworld, and in all good bookshops everywhere. So you pick it up. I do recommend it. Paul Whitcover's, I think he's one of the authors I'm going to be watching from now on, just based on the strength of this book. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, MyAnimeList, DeviantArt, Steam, and various other places on the interwebs. And you can listen to all our previous shows on Mixcloud, and they'll soon be on iTunes and Stitcher as well. We already have The Geek Show and Cinema Eclectica on there anyway, and soon the other shows will be on there. So all of them will be on there. Be happy. And if you want to support us, you can do so by purchasing one of our lovely T-shirts or by clicking on the donate button on the website. So, yes. We have been Literary Loitering. Mm-hmm. I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been elsewhere today, but I've been Jordan as well.
You've been head in the clouds, man.
I have.
Head in the clouds. Man.
Man.
Yeah.
I think he accidentally took a hit of Emperor of All Things.
Yes, yes. It's some good stuff, isn't it? Right, bye.